All righty, we saw the last two or three weeks in Daniel chapter 2 that when tyrants suffer from bad dreams, it means God's at work, right? Isn't that what we got out of chapter 2? But we didn't quite finish chapter 2. We didn't go through the personal implications, the gospel glimpses, whole Bible connections, theological soundings, and then chapter 2 as a whole. That's on page 24 and 25 in your workbook. So I will ask you, did anybody have anything they wanted to share or have written down there about gospel glimpses in chapter 2? Well, if nobody else has something to share, I've got Ryan. Statue, yeah. And gospel glimpses from that? You were just summarizing it. Yes, okay, gotcha. Thank you. Yeah, gospel glimpses in the sense that you see glimpses of the gospel, something that reminds you of something about the gospel in chapter 2.
What would this, what the statue represents? Mm-hmm.
The various four kingdoms.
Yeah.
Yes, Babylon and Persia, Greek and Roman. Yeah. And then the stone smashes it. Is that what you're going after?
Yeah, but I kept thinking Rome in my head.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, no God, only gods could tell you that, King, and they do not dwell with flesh. Yeah, bingo, that's the exact one that I picked out too. That's just amazing. Yeah, verses 10 and 11 is what Nerupa is referring to in chapter 2. The Chaldeans, when the Chaldeans tried to weasel out of the king what the dream was, the king remained firm and said, I know what you're trying to do. You're stalling for time. The Chaldeans answered the king, starting in verse 10, and said, there's not a man on earth who can meet the king's demands, for no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing that the king asks is difficult. No one can show it to the king except the gods. And here we go. This is what Nerupa is referring to. Whose dwelling is not with flesh. Yes. And I think the response of the Chaldeans revealed just how amazing the gospel is. They didn't know it, but reveals to us just how amazing the gospel is. What we read there in verse 11 is the pagan view of God. They're distant. They're far off. They don't associate with us. The only time they pay any attention to us is when we're annoying them. And all that's the actual pagan view of their gods. But That shows us just how amazing the gospel, our God really is, and his gospel is. Because I put down here three things. God did dwell with us, was present, dwelt among his people in the Garden of Eden, in the Exodus, you know, the burning bush, also the column of smoke and the column of fire, the temple and tabernacle. And then, as Nehrupa referred to, God the Son, the eternal Word, became flesh and dwelt among us, John 1:14. And now he dwells in us, John 14:18 through 20, and Colossians 1:27. So the pagan view, the Chaldeans' view, their dwelling isn't with us. They don't pay any attention to us, but the gospel says our God does. He created us to have us in his presence in an intimate relationship with them. He created us to be with him and him to be with us. So anyway, what about whole Bible connections? I think the author went over two things underneath that, the everlasting kingdom and the concept of mystery. I didn't know if any of you commented on any of those under whole, on page 24 under number 2, or if you had something else that you put down there. Well, I zeroed in on that concept of mystery. I just think it's, I love John 15:15. I'll start in verse 12, but Jesus speaking to his disciples, he says, "This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you." Now, verse 15 is what I really love. "No longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you." He calls us his friends. And he reveals the Father's plans to us because we're his friends. He died on the cross to make us his friends. And then in... I put down some other verses to go along with that. 1 Corinthians 2:6-12, Ephesians 1:17-20, and Colossians 1:24-27. I don't know that we need to go over those, but that Colossians 2 talks about how we have been given the Spirit of God and the Spirit. We've been given the Spirit of God so that we can know the deep things of God. Ephesians 1:17-20 talks about God having enlightened our eyes and our hearts so that we can know his work for us, for the church. And Colossians 1:24-27, Paul says that his ministry is to complete the Word of God, to fill it up so that we can know the riches of our hope, which is Christ in you. So I just jotted all that down, and this is what impresses me about it. I think what a massive blessing to be rescued, renewed, made a friend of Christ, a temple of the Holy Spirit, and have the mysteries and deep things of God given to us. That's, you could see that that's not what the pagans had, right? What a massive blessing. That's what they were after in chapter 2, right? These dark things. He got this dream of this statue. And he called all of his wise men because he didn't understand it. This is a dark thing. This is something unrevealed, unexplained. What's going on here? But with us, we're not thrown into those situations because Christ has rescued us, renewed us, made us his friend, given us the Spirit, and has given us understanding of the mysteries and the deep things of God. What a blessing. Did anybody have any theological soundings that they wanted to comment on? I didn't, but I just wondered if any of you did. Oh, yeah. The increasing strength.
And I just kept going back to the First Corinthians passage about God using the weak things of the world to move them.
Oh.
Or God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong.
Yeah. Yeah, yes, yes. Or the other end of his life, when he was born, the way Herod felt threatened by talks of Messiah. And when the Magi did not return to him and tell him where the child could be found, he sent a large armed guard company of soldiers to take out the babies of Bethlehem. And
how fragile is our strength when it is,
yeah, that's right. And he was a baby. And Herod, the king, with an armed, I don't know if it was a platoon or what it was, but a part of his army, couldn't even conquer a baby. Couldn't even locate him. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Availeth much. Daniel bursts into the room where Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is. I like to refer to them by their Hebrew names, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. But he bursts into the room and says, "Seek mercy." And that's what the four of them did. And God answered and gave Daniel understanding of the dream and its interpretation. It's pretty cool. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Absolutely. Well, what about Daniel 2 as a whole? There's something that I really love in this chapter that I hadn't mentioned before. I love the way God loudly announced his intentions regarding his kingdom. That's what chapter two, that's what's happening in chapter 2. God is very loudly announcing his intentions regarding the kingdom. Consider, I got four things about that written down. Consider this. We were just, in chapter 2, we're just 3 years into the captivity. The second and third phases of the deportation from Jerusalem hadn't even happened. Ezekiel hadn't even been deported to Babylon. Ezekiel didn't get deported to Babylon until the second phase of the wave of deportations. So we're very early on in the captivity, 3 years. And God announced his intentions regarding God's own kingdom. He announced those intentions to Nebuchadnezzar in a way that required divine interpretation and threw the entire imperial government into a panic. Isn't that what we're reading in the first part of chapter 2? God gave this tyrant this dream that disturbed him and he didn't understand it. And it threw the entire imperial government in a panic. Nebuchadnezzar called everybody that's got anything going for him and said, "You tell me the dream and its interpretation, or I'm going to kill you." The government, you know, the city of Babylon was in kind of a panic. At that time, the whole empirical government. This is the way God's announcing his intentions. He didn't just give Daniel the dream and all that. This is the way he's doing. This is why I say he's announcing it loudly. Because he goes to the king and he announces it to the king in a way the king doesn't understand. And it ends up throwing the entire government in a panic. And then the third thing to consider is that the king and his empire, think about that. It got the whole capital city's attention, right? All the government officials, all the wise men's attention, everybody's attention. They're absolutely scared to death what's going to happen as a result of this furious king that is having a hard time getting an answer to his question. The king... Because of that situation, the king and his empire had to be instructed by a Jewish teenager who was barely out of manhood. He was 18, 15 when he and his three friends were deported. So they just graduated Babylon U in chapter 1. So they're 3 years into the captivity. He's 18 years old. And God announces it in a way, not only that he grabs the entire attention of the empire and throws the whole government in a panic, but in a way in which they have to be instructed by a Jewish teenager barely out of his manhood. And then, as a result of Daniel interpreting the dream, naming what the dream is and interpreting it, the other thing is, I can't even read my handwriting. He was promoted to the highest, this 18-year-old boy who instructed the the entire empire was promoted to the highest position in the empire except for the king. I mean, you just meditate on those things. You just think about those things. What a riot. I love the way that God announced it. And then lastly, in chapter 2, verse 4, the language that Daniel writes in, he switches from Hebrew, which is the local provincial language of Israel, one of the many nations that had been conquered by Babylon. He switches from Hebrew to Aramaic, which is the international business language of the empire. And it was going to be the international business language of the Persian Empire after Babylon. It's like the whole, you know, God announced it in a way that got everybody's attention through the government in a panic. They had to be instructed by a Jewish teenage kid, and then it was recorded in the international language of the empire so everybody could read it. Now, that's what I say, that's what I call announcing your plans very loudly. I just love that whole perspective on chapter 2. So I don't know if anybody else had anything, any overall perspective on chapter 2. You went, Deepak. Oh. Yeah, that's the ultimate promotion. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, same thing. His life was on the line there, wasn't it? Yeah, he was being pressured not to share the gospel. That's why he got himself into that whole situation. Yeah, that's good. Oh yeah. Like Wes said this morning, we have the freedom to proclaim the gospel in this country, and that's not very common in the world. And that doesn't strike us. We don't think about that. We just take it for granted because we grew up in that kind of freedom. But storm clouds are gathering. So, well, good. We're ready for chapter 3 then. Just wanted to say just a little bit about the way that Daniel structured chapter 3. Every single commentary I wrote, one of the first things they talk about is Daniel's artistry in this chapter, the subtleties that he uses to reveal two things. I'm not going to get too explicit because that'll answer some questions in the first couple of questions in here. But Daniel is a very skilled writer, and we see that coming out very clearly in chapter 3. We're going to see some of that. The whole hinge point of the chapter is verses 16 through 18. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah's confession to the king. But anyway, let's read what the author has to say there on page 27, the place of the passage. In Daniel 3, 1 through 30, we see the faith of Daniel's three friends put to the test. Nebuchadnezzar erects a great statue and commands all people to fall down and worship it. Daniel's friends refuse and are thrown into a fiery furnace. But God delivers them from this peril and vindicates his own power in the eyes of Nebuchadnezzar, who responds, as we saw in Daniel 2, by ascribing praise to the God of Israel and honoring Daniel's three friends. In this chapter, we see God's power at work, rescuing his people from a most perilous situation, which serves to confirm that there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way. Now, top of page 28. Well, in this, the author divides this section up into verses 1 through 7, the nations worship Nebuchadnezzar's statue. Verses 8 through 29, the three friends preserved in the fiery furnace. And then verse 30, their promotion. But most divide this chapter up into seven sections. The first seven verses is a royal decree. And then in verses 8 through 12, there's the accusation against the three. And then in verses 13 and 15, you see the royal rage. And he orders obedience to the three. And then the fourth section, the middle section of this whole passage, verses 16 through 18, is the resolve of the three that we see, their confession. And then the fifth section, royal rage again. Execution is ordered. And then in 24 through 27, we see, instead of the accusation of the three, we see the deliverance of the three. And then in the last section, 28 through 30, another royal decree, only this time, instead of worship the image, it's vindication of the three and praise of their God. So, but he lumps a lot of these sections together. So I'm not sure if we're going to get much out of, I don't mean we're not going to get very much out of this first section. I don't know if we're going to get much past this first section is what I'm trying to say. The author writes this about this first section. The statue Nebuchadnezzar builds is different from the one he saw in his dreams. And so then he asks two questions. He makes that comment, and then the author asks two questions. The first question is, what is the difference? And then the second question is, what does this suggest about Nebuchadnezzar's view of himself and his empire? And I just realized we didn't read the chapter, so let me read these first seven verses, okay, before we address those questions. Daniel 3, 1 through 7. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. A cubit is roughly the length of the forearm of a man. So it wasn't exactly consistent. It usually works out to be about 18 inches or a foot and a half. But there's also a long cubit, which is an extra hand breadth. And so, but anyway, if we just take it as the normal cubit, 18 inches. He's talking 90 feet high and nine feet wide. Okay? Now just listen to this. Listen to this. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, I don't know whether the A is short or long. Then the satraps, the prefects and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up." And so, the author says, this image is different than the one that we saw in chapter 2. This image that Nebuchadnezzar made. His first question is, what is the difference? Pardon? It's all gold. Yeah, it's all gold. We don't know exactly what it was. We presume the most likely thing is that it was an image of his patron god, either Marduk or Nebo. It might have been Nebo because that's the god that Nebuchadnezzar is named after. That first section, that first part of Nebuchadnezzar's name, Nebu, is the god Nebu. Nebo. So if you read carefully in there, it doesn't say it was an image of Nebuchadnezzar. It was an image. Now, later on, there's some indications that it was probably, most likely, a god. Look, and let me give you those verses. If you look in verses 12, 14, and 18. You can see that. In 12, it's the malicious, jealous bureaucrats that are telling on the Jews in verse 12. "There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you." And here's how they don't pay attention to him. "They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." No mention of worshiping him. They don't serve your gods and worship the image. Same thing in verse 14. "Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, 'Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? And then in verse 18, and this is the three speaking, responding to Nebuchadnezzar. This is the gut punch right here. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. In the ancient Near East, the king was thought to represent, be the human on earth representative of the patron god of the state. So to worship the god is to show absolute loyalty to the king and to the state. That's just the frame of thinking in the ancient Near East. So when they three times say they're not serving your gods and worshiping your image, most scholars deduce that the image was probably, they say the most likely thing is the image was of either Marduk or Nebo, and maybe most likely Nebo, since that's the god for whom Nebuchadnezzar was named. So right. I just thought I'd add that on to Julie's comments. So Julie says, one of the differences is the image is all gold. The statue in chapter 2 was made up of four metals and clay, all in descending intrinsic value, but increasing strength. But this image is all gold. And so then another, is there any other difference? Well, I just said it, didn't I? It was its patron god, and not the same kind of image that was in chapter 2. Now, the second question is this. Did anybody have any other differences? So what's the significance? I mean, do you think probably Nebuchadnezzar got his inspiration for this image from the statue that from his dream in chapter 2? Most believe probably so. So the fact that this image that he had set up is different than the statue, what is the significance of that? What kind of significance would you attach to that? Gabe.
It might be giving Nebuchadnezzar's intellectual acuity too much credit, but one thing I thought of was the statue being completely gold sort of symbolizes that he believes his kingdom won't come to an end, essentially.
Very good. Many attribute that kind of a thought to Nebuchadnezzar. Yeah.
I don't know what it is tonight, but I cannot see my notes. So you know what you do in those kind of situations? You put them right under your face and you take your glasses off. Yes. Anything else?
I thought it was kind of telltale that even though he had thrown the kingdom into a panic to get the answer that he wanted, it's almost like he relegated the whole thing just to a chunk of data, just a piece of information. So, okay, I got that figured out. This is going to go over here. Now I'm going to do what I'm going to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's the, you know, I took away from that. It was just dismissed.
Yeah. Well, yes, there's some points he clearly missed in chapter 2, wasn't it? That he clearly dismissed in chapter 2. Yes, you're absolutely right. And I think we're going to see some of that in the next questions here. Yeah. Right. Well, you know, it's... No, but I think you're absolutely right. Yeah. Yes, yes. That same issue is going to resurface next chapter, isn't it? Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah, he won't serve their gods or worship the image. Yeah, no, and I can, and that would be why some assume that the image is Nebuchadnezzar.
Could we also say that Nebuchadnezzar quite possibly felt extremely threatened by
Oh.
I got to put on this massive nationwide, planet-wide ceremony to make sure that everybody still knows that my God is the boss.
Yeah, I think what it, did you have something, Karen? Yes. Right. Right. So when he said Daniel's God is the God of gods and the King of lords, he clearly had not recognized the implications of that. He was just impressed with Daniel's God. So he says, you're in the upper echelon, but you're not it, obviously. Oh.
I'll give him the accolade because he can do this.
Right.
But my gods can do some other stuff.
Yeah. But notice the progression here, and then I'm gonna do what Nick was trying to avoid. Notice the progression here in chapter 2. Nebuchadnezzar gets this dream that he does not understand, and he can't get answers. It is dark. It is mysterious. It is unrevealed. And there's nothing he can do to get information and insight on this thing. So he's got to go to Daniel's God, to Israel's God. And God, Israel's God uses a teenage boy barely out of his manhood to deliver the message. He still doesn't get it. In chapter 3, what is Nebuchadnezzar? So that in chapter 2, there's not a God that can reveal things like that. What's he say at the end of chapter? What does Nebuchadnezzar say about Israel's God at the end of chapter 3? Nobody can deliver like you. But then what does he say at the end of chapter 4? But I mean at the end of chapter 4. Yeah. Oh, you're the Most High God. You are the one that sets up kings. So we finally got it, right? I mean, that, and let me show you the significance of that. That very phrase came up in chapter 2 after God had revealed the dream and its interpretation to Daniel, and Daniel was praising God in verse 21. I'll start in verse 20. Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings." What phrase is used 9 times in the first 15 verses of chapter 3? This word, sets up. That's one of the repetitions in chapter 3. Only there it's Nebuchadnezzar set up this image. You know, it's kind of interesting. He obviously, Nebuchadnezzar missed the message in chapter 2. No, the reason there's this progression of kingdoms is because God, the God, Israel's God, Yahweh, he removes and sets up kings. He's the one that does that. And now, like you guys are pointing out, in chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar builds this big gold image. One of the implications from that is, hey, Nebuchadnezzar is exalting his reign, and he is building this image to leave an unforgettable token of his reign. He's, by doing this, what he's trying to leave his mark, his legacy, for others that come after him to remember. It's unforgettable and all of that. And so it strikes us, like you guys have said, that he's putting off or even trying to prevent the end of his kingdom. Okay? And so he misses that thing from Daniel in chapter 2, that it's God who removes and sets up kings. So in order to try to bolster the everlastingness of his kingdom, he's setting up this image. But it's interesting that Daniel uses the same word. And not only does he use the same word, but he does it multiple times. 9 times in the first 15 verses. Daniel's mocking him. Daniel's mocking this whole scenario here in these first 7 verses of chapter 15, but I'm getting ahead of myself. It's so exciting. So anyway, anybody else have anything else that they wanted to add to the significance of Nebuchadnezzar's image and the way that it differs from the statue in chapter 2? If not, then let's move on to what the author says next. He writes this in the middle of the page. When describing the dedication of the great statue, these verses contain some seemingly unnecessary repetition. For example, the list of the officials present, or the list of musical instruments used. I would also add the repetition of King Nebuchadnezzar set up this image, because that's the thing that's repeated the most. It's repeated 9 times in the first 15 verses, and then in the last 15 verses, it's only repeated twice. What effect is created by all this repetition? Is it positive or negative? And what does it say about the people involved? So, first of all, let me just point out the repetitions, and then we can talk about what's the significance of that. He's already pointed out two of them. The first one is set up or raised up 9 times in those first 15 verses. Then he refers to the repetition of the list of officials. It's quite a list. And then in verses 2 and 3, and then list of musical instruments. Actually, in the first 15 verses, he repeats that list 4 times, verses 5, 7, 10, and 15. I'll just start with what he has there in the paragraph. What do you think is the effect created by these repetitions, like, for instance, the repetition of the list of officials?
When I was reading that, my mind immediately went to Jeremiah's basic training for graduation. You know, and how everybody's...
Okay, I had to think. Seth's son, Jeremiah, not the prophet, Jeremiah. Yeah. So apply it to this?
Well, just that what's happening here is the king's making it clear across the nations who's following his command. There's no doubt, no mystery about it whatsoever.
Right.
That's what I saw.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yep. That's for sure. Anybody else have anything else? What answers did you put down there? Yes. And that's a very important point, Lily, because that's one of the indications. That's one of the effects of repeating all those lists of officials, is that really, more than anybody else, applies to all his underlings in government. Now, something that you wouldn't necessarily pick up just on the reading here, all these lists of officials, these are all provincial officials, leaders. It does not include the city of Babylon, the leaders in the city of Babylon. Many commentators feel it's because Nebuchadnezzar's already purged those that he can't trust in the city, and now he's going after the officials in all the provinces, including the province of Babylon. But all of the terms that are used of the officials, none of them indicate officials in the city of Babylon itself and in the court which might explain the obvious absence of who? Daniel. Okay? Daniel, remember, remained in the court. So that's one of the explanations. I mean, we don't know for sure why Daniel's not in here, but that's one of the explanations is these lists of officials apply to the provincial officials, the provincial governments, and not to the capital city of Babylon itself. So that's good observation, Lily. Yes, this dedication ceremony is for sure got a lot of political motivation behind it. Remember, we said in answering that previous question that in the ancient Near East, the king is thought to be the on-earth human representative of the patron god of the state. And so to worship the god is to give, is to show absolute authority, loyalty to the king and to the state. This is probably the motivation for this image and this ceremony, because of some things that you that we read in the book of Jeremiah and other places. Probably the historical context of this. Notice he didn't give us any in the so-and-so year of Nebuchadnezzar or anything. He didn't give us any kind of historical marker like that in chapter 3. But Zedekiah in Jeremiah chapter 51, verses 59 through 64, Zedekiah was summoned back to Babylon. And if you read chapters 50, 51, it's God's judgment that he's going to bring on Babylon. And at the end of it, Jeremiah tells Zedekiah's secretary, now write this all down on the book, seal the book, and when you go with Zedekiah to Babylon, he says, I want you to read this out, this book, which is Jeremiah chapters 50 and 51. I want you to read this out, and then I want you to tie it up, put a stone on it, and throw it into the Euphrates River. And because the way that book with that stone on it sinks to the bottom of the Euphrates is the way that I'm going to cause Babylon to sink. You can read that in chapters 50 and 51. So in chapter 51, verses 59 through 64, is where Zedekiah is summoned back to Babylon. And that may be the historical context for this dedication ceremony. And the reason Zedekiah was summoned to Babylon is because Zedekiah had the envoys of three or four countries, Moab, the Amorites, and a couple other countries in his court, and they were plotting how they can resist Babylon. Obviously, Nebuchadnezzar hears about it, and so he summons him back to Babylon. And so you can imagine, if that's the historical context of this dedication ceremony that we see in Daniel chapter 3, then Nebuchadnezzar, this is very politically motivated. What his main point is to extract from the government officials in all of the provinces of Babylon, to extract from them this sign of absolute loyalty to Nebuchadnezzar and the empire. Okay? So, where we get that is just simply the reason why is he repeating this list of officials? Then you go back in Jeremiah and you read what may be the historical context and you think, okay, we can see what's going on here. What about the list of musical instruments? What do you think? Why do you think he repeats that? I mean, because it's quite a mouthful, right? Why didn't he just say the worship band? he lists all these instruments, you know, and he repeats it.
I would just be guessing it.
That's all of us are doing.
Does it have something to do with each of those instruments maybe was representative natively to, you know, each one of the prophecies?
I haven't read that. Pardon? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Scotland's represented there. What most people think is it gave, I mean, that's quite a musical. All this was a signal to when to bow down. So it gives a very clear, unmistakable, unavoidable sign when to bow down. You can't say, oh, I missed the prompt. You know, you had this huge orchestra just blasting out all of a sudden. That's the sign. Yes. Yeah, and Nebuchadnezzar himself. Yeah, I mean, the whole ceremony is just ridiculous pomp, right? And so now we're getting on to something, what Daniel's doing here. Repeats the official lists twice, repeats the musical instrument list four times. He repeats this phrase, Nebuchadnezzar set up this image, nine times in these first 15 verses, and it's interesting when you start reading the commentaries, every one of them says what Daniel's doing is he's mocking this whole ceremony. He's showing what a farce it is. You know, this impressive image, Nebuchadnezzar set it up. It's all just a setup. Nebuchadnezzar set up that image. He's getting all of the government officials, because notice in verse 4 and in verse 7, he adds all the people's nations, these government officials from all the people's nations and whatnot in there. So it's like he's creating this whole scene where he's got this huge image, which doesn't mean a thing because Nebuchadnezzar had it built and he set it up. But and he's summoning all of these officials and he's telling them, you have, when you hear this incredible worship band break out in music, you have to bow down to this image. So he's kind of mocking it through this repetition. So what does it say about the people involved? Well, that was the decree, that everybody has to do it. But the whole story, because they end up doing it except for those three Jews, what's this say? Oh, it's five after already. I didn't even recognize. Whew. Bye, Nick. Yeah. Two things that I've got down here. It shows the pressure that those three Jewish teenagers faced, because all the government officials. Nebuchadnezzar set this up, repeated over and over and over. So There's a pressure from the authority. There's pressure from conformity. The pressure that these three are under. And then secondly, it shows how comical and farcical this whole event is. The people just unthinking and mechanically fell to their foreheads when the music played. That's the picture that Daniel's creating here for us. You know, Nebuchadnezzar going around, setting up this image, getting all of these people here, threatening them, and then now play. And everybody's just supposed to unthinkingly, mechanically just fall to their foreheads, bow before this king. Now, because Daniel's mocking it doesn't mean he's saying that this isn't a serious thing. This is very serious. It's very serious for those three Hebrew teenagers, right? But it's also just a complete and total farce, which can help with bolstering your courage to do what's right in the face of all of that pressure, seeing what a farce it is and knowing what reality is can strengthen your courage to do what's right under all of that pressure that those three were under. Of course, they didn't have the advantage of Daniel's write-up of it at the time that the event happened, but they could see the farce. So we're going to stop right there, and we'll start up with that second section at the bottom of page 28.